States of America versus Hill. And Mr. Davis?
Davis, yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Lee Davis, and I am here today on behalf of the appellant, Brian Rashad Hill. As the court knows, this was a trial, a fairly lengthy one. In fact, it was the second trial. The first one ended in a hung jury and a mistrial. So this is the appeal of the second trial. And actually, the evidence of guilt in this case was fairly compelling. So my four arguments on appeal focus on sentence-related issues. I believe the strongest of my four issues here on appeal is actually what I put in the brief as argument number four with regard to the jury verdict. As the court knows, Supreme Court cases Apprendi and Aileen and their progeny require a jury finding to justify higher mandatory minimums or statutory maximums. And in this case, the problem was in the verdict form. Admittedly, probably typographical reasons, just nobody caught it. The important question was left out of the verdict form. The verdict asked the questions, did you find a conspiracy involving the cocaine or the heroin? Then it asked a question, did you find that the overall scope of the conspiracy involved 280 grams or more of cocaine? But the verdict form failed to include the final necessary question. Was that something involving Mr. Hill? Was Mr. Hill involved in that? Did he know that there were 280 grams or more of the cocaine? Now, that is an essential question for the district court to be able to impose more than a 0 to 20 year sentence in this case. And unfortunately, on this count, the district court imposed a 40-year, 480-month sentence. Count, and I'm sure I'm going to flip them, I believe count three is a substantive heroin count, and the district court did sentence to 20 years there, 40 years on this conspiracy, and ran them concurrently. The challenge here, though, is that because the jury never answered that question about Mr. Hill specifically and 280 grams or more of cocaine, the district court could not have imposed more than a 20-year sentence on that count. And so that creates the problem now of what do we do? Unfortunately, there was no objection in the trial court. So we're grappling with that fourth prong of the plain error review. Clearly there was error. When you read the record, it's pretty obvious. It certainly it affected his substantial rights because he's now serving a sentence that's twice as long as he could have with that verdict. But the question is, though, does this affect the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of these proceedings? And I think that we can safely say that it does, because we have imposed now on this man a sentence that is literally double that which could otherwise have been imposed with this verdict. And so,
well, that I hear what you're saying. However, if we reduce the fourth prong of plain error review to that, that seems to duplicate the other prongs of plain error review, right? Don't we need some extra ingredient in order to meet the fourth prong? I mean, the fourth prong seems to be talking about something broader than, well, you know, he's got a longer sentence. Well, yeah, that's under the first two prongs.
Yes.
So what should we look to?
Well, simply the gravity of the error. The gravity of the error is so large.
About the gravity of the record against your client. I mean, in other words, the jury didn't answer a specific question on the jury form. The jury was instructed about all the elements, was instructed about the level of cocaine that had to be at play, that he had to know about it. And the jury comes back and says guilty. And the indictment charged it as well. But it seems to me there's just reams of evidence that he knew this was a substantial conspiracy, well above 280 grams. So wouldn't we consider the totality of what was adduced and discussed at trial?
Well, the government's brief would, the government devotes a couple of pages plus of their brief seemingly essentially asking this court to make this jury finding here for that very reason, because there is a lot of evidence in this case about the scope, both in terms of time and quantity of the narcotics being distributed here. But the problem is it's a jury question. And we have to have that answer from the jury. And when you look at, for example, sufficiency of the evidence review, the court...
Well, but if our question is whether this result seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings, that strikes me as a different question. It's not, I mean, maybe sufficiency of the evidence is tied into that, but where the evidence is plainly sufficient... And the jury just didn't answer the question. I'm not saying it's an unserious problem or issue if there's an error here. It would be a serious error, but we're looking at prong four of plain error review, which strikes me as different than just straight up saying, well, is there sufficiency of the evidence, and we have to let the jury say that.
Certainly, but I mean, this is now an illegal sentence because he's been subject to a range of punishment not provided for by law. And of course, we have the gravity of the error. This is different than perhaps we're arguing over a two-level sentencing guidelines issue, where a couple of levels typically in the guidelines just takes you from the top of one range to the bottom of the other, perhaps. And so in that kind of situation, you would see someone, maybe that was error, but they're sentenced well within the statutory range of punishment for an offense. And of course, if you're talking about a factual dispute, then that's a clear error review with respect to what the district judge found. Here we're talking about something that is just beyond the bounds of the law authorized by this jury verdict. And that's...
What was the substance of the argument? Maybe, I don't know if you were trial counsel or not.
I was not, sir.
You were not. So what was the subject of defense counsel's argument that Mr. Hill did not, in fact, know that the conspiracy involved more than 280 grams of cocaine, if that's the right figure?
I honestly can't tell you off the top of my head what was argued in the trial court on that specific point.
Was there an argument that he didn't know there was more than 280 grams of cocaine?
Knowing who the trial lawyers were, I fully expect that there was.
Well, there's a record.
And I just, unfortunately, I can't answer that question. I'm happy to get back to the court with a...
maybe on rebuttal.
The part of the aspect, too, with respect to what he could have known, though, is that his role, Mr. Hill's role, was small-time dealer and kind of enforcer to keep order there at the Han Gill Hotel. So presumably he had some knowledge of other goings on here and there, but we can't say for sure what he really did know.
Well, he was an enforcer, he was a bagger, he was monitoring some of the other trap rooms. I mean, some of that flows into the drug quantity calculation as well, which I know you're contesting. But it strikes me that what the court did was take the conservative approach and sort of give him every benefit of the doubt, and it was still a very substantial amount of drugs that he knew about.
And that may be the case, Your Honor, but the challenge with respect to the drug quantity in the PSR is we have virtually nothing in the PSR that we can say, oh, that's how that number was calculated. You know, when we look at that drug quantity calculation, it's extolled as a conservative estimate, but we don't know where it came from. It's billed as consistent with the other defendants, which may or may not be appropriate. That kind of flies in the face of the concept of individualized sentencing. You know, if he legitimately should have been held accountable for the same quantity as these other folks, then that's fine, but we need to know where that number came from and why that's a legit number for Mr. Hill, and that's where those numbers there break down.
Aren't those numbers also consistent with some of the testimony at trial, though, Wasn't there testimony at trial that 600 to 800 grams of cocaine base were sold a month, and that 600 grams to a kilogram of heroin were sold per month by the witness who testified, I believe, that she worked 2 to 3 shifts each week over the month? I think, wouldn't that mean, at least by my calculations, that a trap room overall would sell more than a kilogram of each drug, both cocaine, powder cocaine, and cocaine base in a month? Wasn't there testimony like that at trial?
Yes, sir. There was a good bit of testimony about that at trial in terms of different people talking about different activities that they participated in and or saw. But the problem that we have here is nobody took that and said, okay, well, this looks like good information, and we're going to extrapolate that. You know, I literally look at the PSR and say, I have no idea where this came from. And so was it, you know, person A, person B, person C talking about that? How did they determine, perhaps more importantly, that that specific conduct was then reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Hill if he did not participate in it?
Well, the district judge had presided over both the first and second trial, of course, and conducted a extensive, thorough sentencing hearing. Are you saying it has to be in the PSR?
Well, the PSR is supposed to do that. I mean, if you read Rule 32, and if you look at Section 3553A, a properly calculated sentencing guidelines range is the basis for federal sentencing. I mean, that only begins that process. And the interesting thing, and perhaps it was an oversight, but in the government's motion for upward departure, the government did spend about a page of a, I think, 14 or 15 page motion talking about some of the things that the court just noted, that there were some people who testified at trial. But that didn't get into the reasonable foreseeability issue, what the government put in that motion, nor did the probation officer include that in the PSR. And the PSR, or the probation officer, did generate a second addendum to the PSR after the government filed this motion for upward departure and combined response to objections. So obviously the record doesn't tell us why the probation officer didn't treat that, but we know that the probation officer is charged with only including reliable information in the report and information that has that, you know, basis, legitimate basis, a facial basis that we can look at and say, okay, that may not agree with it, but at least it makes some sense. And so that's the challenge there. And so maybe, you know, this could be a situation where if this court sends this case back, Mr. Hill may really regret going back, because the drug quantity, when someone sharpens the pencil, as my CPA father says, gets a whole lot bigger. But, you know, he's not going to turn out a whole lot worse at resentencing. So that's where we're asking this court to say, hey, let's just do this right. Let's adhere to the standards and the procedures that we have to follow for federal sentencing. Now, admittedly, this, and you can see some of this in the PSR and some of it is in the trial testimony, this is a difficult situation to be able to get that accurate estimate or extrapolation, because the nature of the setup was such that law enforcement did have a very difficult time getting in there. And so there was not a lot of information that you see in a lot of cases where we can say for certain person X was dealing Y amount of a quantity over a certain period of time. So it's naturally going to be a more challenging case, but just because it's harder doesn't mean it doesn't have to be done. And I think with 14 seconds left, that's probably a good point for me to stop unless the court had a question.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Mitchell.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Amy Mitchell for the United States. I want to start in the same place that Mr. Davis did, and that is with the fourth issue. There is no clear or obvious error here. Hill argues that in order to be subject to an increased statutory maximum, the jury had to make an individualized drug quantity determination. That's contrary to this court's case law, and it ignores the jury's findings. This court's post-Apprendi and post-Aleen precedent holds that in the context of a statutory maximum, the government does not need to prove or have the jury find an individualized drug quantity. The jury's finding as to the conspiracy as a whole is sufficient. Here, the jury found by special question that the conspiracy involved 280 grams or more of cocaine base. And based on that alone, Mr. Hill cannot show error.
Doesn't the jury also have to show knowledge that the conspiracy, that knowledge on Hill's part that the conspiracy encompassed that? I mean, his part of it, not his role necessarily, but doesn't the jury have to make a finding about the knowledge?
The jury did make that finding here.
Where is it?
I mean, it's in the fifth element of the jury instructions.
So it's in the instructions, but yes. You've got a problem with the fifth element in that it has an or in there, not an and. In other words, I've been trying to square this circle and add up how the jury instructions, the evidence at trial, and the jury verdict form, the interrogatory form, can get us there. But you're saying we don't have to get there.
But correct. Then, but I'm then, saying you don't have to get there.
And we just go by what the instructions gave the jury, and we have an implicit finding that he knew?
No, I think it's sufficient that there is a finding as to the conspiracy as a whole. Hmm. I mean, the Turner is still good law. More recently, Aikens, Gonzalez. This court's case law treats the minimum sentence differently than the maximum sentence. But to answer your question, the jury found both a quantity of heroin and 280 grams of crack cocaine as to the conspiracy as a whole. It follows that they would have found that fifth element as well, because it is.
So you're saying that even though the fifth element said or, the jury came back with an and, so therefore it must have been.
Essentially, yes. Yes.
Because what's your best case that supports that?
It follows that because they found one and the fifth element is required, they found that as well.
What's your best case that supports that?
I don't have one off the top of my head. I can tell you, I'll, you know, reiterate that finding isn't required to increase the statutory maximum.
I mean, I have here in front of me a case of ours called Montemayor. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes.
Okay, and I'm quoting, a jury must, quote, determine the drug amount which each defendant knew or should have known was involved in conspiracy.
Yes.
And you're saying the jury found that he knew there was more than 280 grams of cocaine base?
By convicting him based on these jury instructions, yes.
Okay, well, I guess I'm just replowing the ground that Judge Wilson just plowed. All right, well, let's assume we disagree with you.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Let's assume we disagree with you.
Okay.
Do you lose?
There is no effect on his substantial rights.
Wait a second. Didn't Mr. Davis was saying that he was looking at 480 instead of doubled his sentence, right? That's not substantial.
He would still have, there would still be two counts here that could add up to 40 years in prison. And the
we can't infer that the court would go back and make it consecutive as opposed to concurrent, can we? I mean, that's the crux of your argument. Well, it would have been 480 regardless.
It's very clear from this record that the court was going to impose a very significant sentence.
All right, great, but that doesn't mean that, well, if the court had known that the statutory maximum was 240, the court would have just added 240 plus 240 as opposed to 480, including 240. Where's your evidence for that?
Again, just the court was certainly going to impose a significant sentence here. And to maybe help answer your question, I'll move on to the fourth prong.
That might be a good one.
Even if the other prongs were satisfied, the court shouldn't exercise its discretion in order resentencing because overwhelming and uncontroverted evidence showed that Hill was individually accountable for way more than 280 grams of crack cocaine.
Well, so Judge Duncan asked this of counsel opposite during the main presentation there. What is required under the fourth prong? I mean, where do we delineate our discretion in exercising it or not exercising it? Is it enough that the evidence was overwhelming? Is it sort of a sufficiency of evidence question, or is there some guidepost we can follow as to when to exercise it and when not to?
When looking at the fairness of the sentence or the fairness of what went on here, the evidence is really extremely clear that there's way more than 280 grams of crack. I mean, Mr. Hill, when he was in a conspiracy with co-defendants Madison Brecky and Kareem Saleem, in just that 14-week period of time, they sold almost 800 grams of crack cocaine. And that doesn't even, you know, include what was being sold in Eric Freeman's trap rooms.
So it's a sufficiency of evidence inquiry that we're basically making in exercising the fourth prong, exercising our discretion or not exercising our discretion?
In a way, yes, it is.
Because, I mean, does it change the calculus that we're dealing not with just a guidelines range, but a statutory maximum? In other words, if it's above 280, statutory maximum is higher. If it's below 280, it's 20 years.
I think that does play into the calculus, but I think the calculus here, the result is the court should not exercise its discretion.
Well, it's got to mean something. I mean, the Supreme Court reversed us, as I recall, in, was it Rosales-Morales? Was that it? The case they reversed us in when we construed the fourth prong of plain error review to be something, I forget what we said. I didn't write it. But they said we had it too high. Shocks the conscience, something like that. But it's got to mean something. And I'm, you know, what's your best case that would guide us in applying the fourth prong in a case like this?
It's actually Montemayor, the case that you mentioned, because the court found no effect on the fairness, integrity, public reputation of the courts there.
I'm not sure, frankly, as I sit here, that it should be reduced to a sufficiency standard, although that's probably part of it. I mean, here wasn't the jury instructed properly. It just was asked the wrong question. The question wasn't phrased properly.
Yes, the jury was instructed properly. It just didn't, as you said, there was no special question.
If we think there was an error, then it's the phrasing of the question that was off.
Correct. I want to talk next about the drug quantity.
Do you recall, the counsel couldn't provide me the information, but what was the argument that was made at trial as to why Mr. Hill didn't have the requisite knowledge? Do you recall?
There was no argument to that effect with regard to the specific quantity of crack. His defense was essentially, I was sort of a bit player. I was mostly just an addict. I didn't really know that this big conspiracy was going on. That was his defense at trial.
I guess what I'm getting at there is, was there some pointed argument about why he couldn't have possibly known, you know, about the full scope of the conspiracy and, you know.
There's no way.
So we ought to construe the jury as having rejected that. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
There was no evidence. There was no argument to that effect. But the evidence that the government presented clearly demonstrated more than 280 grams of crack cocaine.
Okay.
Next, like I said, I'll go to the drug quantity determination since we're sort of on that topic. The district court didn't just rely on the PSR here. The district court specifically referenced the co-defendant's testimony during the sentencing hearing and in addressing the objection to the drug quantity determination. And, you know, that drug quantity determination doesn't even include everything that would have been foreseeable to Mr. Hill or that he was directly involved in. That estimate was based primarily on what was going on in Eric Freeman's trap rooms. And there were 10 to 15 trap rooms operating at any given time in this conspiracy. And Mr. Hill sold crack and heroin on his own. He sold it with Madison Brecky and Kareem Saleem. And then he worked 12-hour shifts in Freeman's trap rooms, where they sold every kind of drug. It wasn't just heroin and crack. They sold methamphetamine, they sold powder cocaine, they sold marijuana. And none of those other substances were included in that drug quantity determination. And that's why it is very clear that that was a very conservative estimate. And it was fully supported by the record here. The next thing I want to talk about is the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. Mr. Hill compares himself specifically to Mr. Freeman and to Mr. Washington and says, oh, they were way more involved, their behavior was so much worse than mine, and the record does not show that at all. It's the opposite, in fact. He is just as bad, perhaps in some ways worse than they were. On his last night at the Hong Gil, he worked a 12-hour shift as the doorman in one of Freeman's trap rooms, and then he stayed to hang out and smoke some crack. And he handed some of that crack to Lily Rarick. And a little bit later, she also injects herself with heroin, and she's falling out of her chair. She is so high that she's nodding in and out of consciousness. And Mr. Freeman he's seeing all of this. It's very clear, this is on the surveillance video. He takes her into the bathroom, he sexually assaults her, and he either kills her or lets her die of a drug overdose. And that was just his last night there. He'd been there for over a year at that point. He was one of the first people at the Hong Gil, aside from Mr. Munn, the owner. He was the first drug dealer at the Hong Gil. And he was the biggest drug dealer at the Hong Gil until the spring of 2018, when his source of supply, Eric Freeman, moved in and took over. Even then, he continued to sell drugs, crack, heroin, on his own and with others. Again, the drugs he sold with Madison Brecky and Kareem Saleem, those drugs killed two people from overdoses. The Hong Gil conspiracy was linked to at least one more overdose death and one fatal gunshot wound to the head. Mr. Hill was on the cleanup crew for that body. He and others took that young man's body and dumped it like garbage. We have no idea who he is, and his body's never been found. Witnesses also said that Hill was violent, that he always carried a handgun, sometimes an assault rifle. They described seeing him pistol whip a woman because she owed him money, and then another saw Hill beating a man to unconsciousness and then stomping on his head while he lay on the ground. So in just 9 months, we're talking about three lives lost, two beatings, and two people dumped like garbage. And the whole time he was at the Hong Gil, Mr. Hill also worked security for Mr. Munn. And that's not the security that you and I would think of when it comes to hotel security. Typically, hotel security is there to keep the guests safe. Mr. Hill was there to secure the drug trade that was going on. He would warn the people in those 10 to 15 trap rooms if the police were nearby. He would remove people who were using out in the open, who were so high they were about to overdose. He would remove them from the hotel so that law enforcement's attention was not drawn to it.
How long did this operation go on, this hotel?
The charged conspiracy is January of 2018 until March of 2019, when we were finally able to shut the hotel down.
Physically, what is it? Or what was it?
What was it? It was originally designed, I guess, to be a nursing home. And when Mr. Munn bought it, he turned it into a hotel. But there were no legitimate guests staying at that hotel. Yeah. It wasn't like somebody was visiting Dallas and went and stayed there. You went there if you wanted to buy drugs or engage in prostitution or something along those lines.
My goodness. Presumably it's all been shut down now.
It is torn down now. Hill was integrally involved in the Hong Gil conspiracy from the very beginning, and his actions along the way as a dealer, as security, as an enforcer, as a doorman, all of those things perpetuated this conspiracy and perpetuated what happened at the Hongil.
Is there a testimony in the record about how many trap houses we're talking about here, if that's the right term? That's what
there was testimony that at any given time there were 10 to 15 trap rooms operating in the
hotel.
Trap
rooms, yeah. What does that mean, trap room?
Just a place you go to buy and sell drugs.
Okay, outside my experience.
Mine as well.
Is there testimony about how many dealers we're talking about over the course of the conspiracy?
No. Not a total number. No, there was no testimony about that. Because for instance, Freeman had two trap rooms, and there might have been other dealers that had more than one at any time. All that being said, the district court's 40-year sentence was solidly based on the evidence here. It's important to remember, Judge Scholler sat through two trials. She saw Mr. Hill's demeanor. She saw the witnesses testify, was able to assess their credibility. She saw all of the exhibits, including the surveillance videos. I mean, this is an interesting case and a unique case in that the judge had like a literal bird's eye view into the operation of this conspiracy and into Mr. Hill's participation in it. The sentence was certainly substantively reasonable.
Could you tell me, as succinctly as possible, what the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's knowledge that there were more than 280 grams of cocaine involved? I mentioned it, and the other judges have, and I think you discussed it in general. But as succinctly as possible, just tell me what the overwhelming evidence of his knowledge that the amount exceeded that amount.
He worked 12-hour shifts in Freeman's trap rooms, where they sold, by my calculation, which is higher than the one that you had, Judge Schrader, approximately 70 grams of crack a day on average. That's in two trap rooms. But he was certainly aware that there was another trap room operated by Eric Freeman. So that alone, and then also his involvement with Madison Brecky and Kareem Saleem. Kareem Saleem testified in the first trial that in the 14 weeks that they were working together, they sold 700, as a conservative estimate, 798 grams of crack. And then also, I mean, obviously, because he was working security for the entire hotel, he would have known the goings-on in the other trap rooms as well. The court has no other questions. I'll cede my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try not to take all of it, but I did want to make a couple of points. With respect to the layout of the hotel itself, government's correct, it's been condemned or forfeited. It's actually been bulldozed, but there are some photos of it in the record. If you are familiar with old school nursing homes, things perhaps built in the 1950s or 60s, it was something of a hub and spoke kind of building, in that it had, I believe it was, five wings all radiating off of a center point. And so there were multiple hallways, and I believe it was approximately 100 rooms total. But one of the challenges in knowing everything and seeing everything and being able to attribute anything that's reasonably reliable to my client, or quite frankly any of the other defendants, is in part that physical layout. You can only see at best about a fifth of the building at a time, unless you just happen to be standing in that very center.
What specifically of the government's description in response to Judge Schrader of the evidence that overwhelmingly shows, in their view, that it was over 280 grams, what specifically do you dispute?
Well, that he could have known what was going on.
Was he a security guy? I mean, was he in charge of the security of the place?
At times, yes, and for different folks there.
And he oversaw several different trap rooms for his own commerce and then others?
At times, yes. But it's important to remember that...
What about the amounts that government's counsel referenced in terms of the, 700 and whatever it was?
It was just a little bit under 800.
He was involved in that.
In grants, yes. That testimony from I believe it was the first trial, does establish that. But it's a question of how much did he know, and in part because of the shifting nature of the conduct there. You know, there were estimated 10 to 15 operating at any given time.
But if he was personally involved with more than 280 grams, would that not be enough if he's also been convicted of as being a conspirator?
Well, and that gets to the second point I was going to make. I disagree with the government's characterization of the verdict form as being improperly or poorly phrased. It's missing an entire question. And we reproduce the portion of it there on page 44 of our brief. And if you look at that, where it says, and if you answer this question, yes, you need to tell us how much the overall conspiracy involved. Okay, well, that's supposed to be there, but there should have been an entirely another question under that that was specific to Mr. Hill.
Was that question asked in the first trial?
I don't recall. I know it was, at one point there were proposed instructions.
Well, there was no objection this time.
Exactly.
Presumably there was no objection last time.
And I'm not even sure if it was in there. I've obviously focused more on this later transcript, but there was a proposed charge and form at one point that did omit this, but there were others that had it. And certainly the jury was correctly charged. It's just, this is not a phrasing problem. It's literally a missing essential question.
Fair enough. I think Judge Wilson had a question.
Well, I was just going to ask, what do you make of Montemayor?
I'm afraid, I'm not sufficiently familiar with it to really give the court a good opinion on it.
Well, they were evaluating plain error, and it was amount of drugs was the issue. And the court concluded, in this case, there is overwhelming evidence to support the jury's finding that the conspiracy between Montemayor and Cerda involved more than 5 kilograms of cocaine. They agreed there was plain error. They declined to exercise discretion to correct the error based on that evidence.
And I think the question that leaves in my mind is what was the sentence imposed there? And the concern I keep coming back to here is that instead of a maximum 240-month sentence, he got a 480-month sentence and only got less than the available life sentence that was called for by the guidelines because the district judge opted to offset that anticipated crack powder.
No, I mean, there again, the court gave Hill the benefit of a law that hadn't even been enacted yet and basically corrected the disparity that the court saw. So indulgence for his benefit. In other words, he could have been sentenced to life. But all of this comes into play if we get around the statutory maximum. But I'm asking, I guess, about Montemayor because it appears that what the court did there was look at the sufficiency of the evidence and say, we're not exercising our discretion because it's obvious that the element would have been met.
But that, I think, gets back to my concern about this court substituting its judgment for that of the jury, and of course, is it distinguished?
But that's why I asked you, what do you make of Montemayor?
Yeah, it's precedent of our court. We've got to follow it. Yeah. All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Well-argued case on both sides. We appreciate it. That's cases...